It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. On April 6, 1917, the United States declared war on Germany and the U.S. joined the Great War. More than 114,000 Iowans served in the U.S. Armed Forces during World War I. 3,576 Iowans lost their lives. This hour, we'll look back on this pivotal moment in world history and the role that Iowa played at home and abroad. And with me this hour is Mike Vogt. He is curator for the Iowa Gold Star Military Museum in Johnston. Hello, Mike.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for the invite. Glad to be here.
Leo Landis is also with us. He is curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Hello, Leo.
It's great to be here, too.
And let's go back in time because, of course, World War I began in 1914. The U.S. sat on the sidelines for nearly 3 years before entering the war. Let's paint a picture politically of what was going on in the United States in that lead up to the U.S. declaring war and entering the conflict. Leo?
What you have is President Woodrow Wilson wanting to keep neutral stance, and most of Iowa at the time is not seeing it as a conflict that the United States should be a part of either. And in fact, we have such a strong German population in our state, it's the most represented ethnicity in our state, that you have a lot of people in Iowa who might even be sympathetic toward the German point of view. So the platform then that President Wilson runs on in 1916 is he kept us out of war, and he wins the election. And so you've got this sense of it's a European affair, and it's not something that concerns us Iowans.
So what tipped the scales?
Well, the Germans had been engaged in submarine warfare through the 1914-1915 period, had sunk the Lusitania in 1915, and were then at the outcry after the sinking of the Lusitania were holding back on their submarine warfare. But then in early 1917, the Germans start feeling some of the pressure that if they're really going to win this war, they need to engage in submarine warfare more again. And so they start attacking both merchant ships that they suspect of having munitions or even some passenger ships. And then in February of 1917, and things are starting to change. And then in March, the British share a telegram that had been intercepted from a German ambassador that was called the Zimmermann Telegram, where Germany was trying to pull Mexico into the war by saying, if you join us and we win, we'll give you Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California back. So, or not California, but those other states. So there was then this motivation that Germany's really not going to let us be neutral as the United States.
And when the United States declared war in Iowa, how did that change public opinion? Because we will talk about what it was like on the home front. And, of course, we'll talk about what it was like for Germans living in Iowa, because there were so many later in the hour. But did public opinion then follow the congressional decision?
You do see newspapers across the state, whether it be Spencer or Waterloo. Once war is declared, most Iowans are on board and saying, this is, you know, a fight we need to help win. We need to be a part of it. But even in February and early April, some opinions of people that might be a little more marginalized or people that were outside the mainstream, and by that I mean not in the predominant culture. The Iowa Bystander, the African-American newspaper published in Des Moines in the teens, they run a story on or an editorial on April 6th, not knowing that the war is going to be declared that day, saying every time there's a battle, you know, we're not asked initially because we're not seen as being important to the fight. But once it comes down to we need men, just like when Lincoln asked in the Civil War, we know that we'll be asked to serve and we're going to do that job. But we may not have the opportunity to go to the military academies that people with light-colored skin are, and that's something that even in early April, people like African Americans know that they're going to be asked to fight, but they may not have access to the same rights, and so there is a little bit of concern there.
And as we were watching the war, Mike, we were watching a completely different kind of war than anyone had ever seen before. Leo mentioned the U-boats. That was one kind of technology that was new to World War One, for the most part, at least on this level. What are some of the other ways that warfare had changed at this point in our history?
In 1914, in addition to the nations, science and industry goes to war as well. So chemists and physicists and others had developed weapons, technologies that increased the rate of fire of something as simple as a rifle or a pistol. Machine guns are commonplace on the World War I battlefield. The Germans debut poison gas against the French at the Battle of Ypres in the spring of 1915. And so the mechanization, the industrialization of war begins to take a dreadful toll on human life. The weapons and the ordnance delivered on the battlefield are like nothing seen before in modern times.
As the United States was sitting out the war and, of course, following closely, were people fully aware of the kind of conditions that our soldiers would be entering into once they actually entered the fight?
The Americans were aware. Unfortunately, we were very slow to draw lessons from that European experience. When we eventually commit troops to the First World War following the April 6, 1917 declaration, we still don't have any steel helmets. We still don't have any gas masks. We have about 800,000 Springfield rifles, but that's not enough to arm a force that's going to grow to be large enough to impact the war effort in favor of the Allies.
So we knew what our soldiers would be facing, but we didn't prepare them for it.
Correct. It was that's exactly right.
The Iowans who served in the war, there was a particular unit from Iowa where most of the Iowans were involved. Tell me more about that.
Well, there are two that include Iowans. The largest Iowa-associated unit was the 88th Infantry Division, which was created at Camp Dodge and would deploy from Camp Dodge in July of 1918. The first Iowans to see combat outside of regular Army units or a few Iowans that served with some foreign armies prior to our entry into the war served with the 168 Infantry Regiment, recruited primarily from southeast Iowa as part of the Iowa National Guard. They were assigned to the 42nd Division, and they were among the first half dozen American divisions to arrive in Europe in fall of 1917 and would be committed to combat positions in the spring of 1918.
And where were they in Europe once they were deployed?
They served in the American lines as they were established in training areas were on the southern part of the Western Front. So west of Sedan, west of Metz, in that area of France.
And I know we've all heard a lot about trench warfare, and that's something that you try to really introduce people to at your museum. Tell me specifically about the kinds of conditions that they would have had in those American lines.
Because of the amounts of bullets and bombs and shells rained down on the Allied and Central Power armies, they dug into the ground for protection. And depending on how long an army occupied an area or a section of trenches, they might be very well fitted out as far as the accommodations in other areas. They're mostly mud floors, dirt floors. The Germans had the advantage early in the war of occupying most of the high ground in northern France. So they were able to conveniently pump their sewage and waste down the hill and let it run into the French trenches a few hundred yards away. It depended on how long an army occupied an area as to how accommodating their trench environment may be, but on average, very dismal, rat-infested, lice-infested, inhospitable environment to occupy for any length of time.
Well, I think in the best of trenches, that doesn't sound like the kind of place most of us would want to spend our time, but so many of the trenches were not the best of trenches.
Correct, correct. Yeah, if you have a chance to visit the museum out of Camp Dodds, we've recreated a section of trench, a more well-apportioned trench, accommodated, but you still get the idea of the confining environment, the claustrophobic tendencies of that existence and that type of fortification.
Well, and you mentioned the claustrophobic tendencies. I mean, you're in the trench, so you can't see what's going on, right? I mean, try to recreate the environment for us just by describing it.
Craig, the average trench was 6 to 8 feet deep. Sometimes they would place what they call duck boards or wooden planks in the bottom to help keep soldiers' feet out of the mud. The term trench foot is a byproduct of the First World War. The constant exposure to wet moisture led to a number of skin disorders in soldiers' feet on the Western Front. It's an outside environment, so if you're fighting in the wintertime, it's cold. If you're fighting in the summertime, it's hot. If it's raining, you're getting rained on. There are a few small areas where you can seek refuge from the rain or the wind, dugouts dug below the surface off of the trench, the run of the trench. And barbed wire belts are maybe a few hundred feet, a few hundred yards from the trench position. There were firing steps so that a soldier could walk down the trench and not be exposed to sniper fire or occasional bursts of machine gun fire passing horizontally over the top of the trench. When it was necessary to aim your weapon and fire at an enemy offensive or an enemy trench raid, you could step up onto that 18-inch high, 2-foot high firing step, which would allow you to sight over the sandbags or the dirt and deliver your bullets at the enemy.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We are marking the 100th anniversary of the United States entering World War I, and this is an anniversary that many people are marking, including the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Iowa and the Great War, a new exhibit, opens on April 6th at 9 a.m., so Iowans can learn more about Iowa's role in World War I. With me this hour, Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa, and Mike Vogt, curator of the Iowa Gold Star Military Museum in Johnston. This is Talk of Iowa.
Mr. Reuben started winking, slowly rubbed his...
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are marking the centennial of the United States' entrance into World War I. On April 6, 1917, the U.S. declared war on Germany after sitting on the sidelines and watching the Great War for 3 years. With me this hour, Mike Vogt, curator of the Iowa Gold Star Military Museum in Johnston. Leo Landis is here, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. And I also want to bring Rusty Corder into the conversation. He's also a historian, a former college history professor and museum curator, and he has also been a military reenactor for many years, including World War I reenactments. Hello, Rusty.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And we were just listening to Mike describe what it must have been like to be in the trenches in World War I. And you have been involved in reenacting World War I battles. First of all, tell me why. What is the goal of a reenactment?
For the most parts, and whether we're talking Revolutionary War, Civil War, World War I, World War II, whatever, the primary goal is to educate the public what the clothing was like, the equipment, the uniforms, the tactics. It's an attempt to give the public, and I might even add the reenactors themselves, a little peek through this window of time, so that we can see what these men and women went through in the past.
You have done, as I mentioned, many different kinds of reenactments. I know you started with Civil War reenactment. How did you get involved in World War I reenactment?
I've been doing Civil War cavalry for about 30 years, still am. Moved into World War II Navy, been doing that for, I don't know, 10, 12 years. And a friend of mine suggested that we go into World War II infantry. So we joined up with the 2nd Infantry Division, and just by chance they do World War I over at Midway Village in Rockford, Illinois. And that's how I got involved in the World War I aspect.
As a historian yourself, what kind of research do you do before getting involved in a reenactment to make sure that it is as accurate as possible?
Well, one of the things we do, like for myself, I want to know that I'm wearing my equipment correct. I want to make sure I've got the right color uniform. I want to make sure, and a shade of color can make a big difference. I want to make sure that everything I'm using and wearing is exactly correct to that specific time. Now, luckily for those of us who portray World War I soldiers, our equipment's fairly generic. You know, it's all standardized. But you take someone like my fiance who portrays civilian, she has to do a lot more research into her clothing. So we all spend time just studying old photographs, reading accounts, and then trying to figure out who we would have been, where we would have been, in the exact time period.
And how do you recreate the battlefield? We were just talking about those trenches. Do you actually dig trenches?
Yes. There are places, Rockford's one of them. There's a place in Pennsylvania, I think there's one in Indiana, which they have trenches dug. Now, true to form, the German trenches, like at Rockford, are much better than the Allied trenches. Now, we don't have all the horrors of the original trenches. I mean, we're not wading in mud up to our knees. We don't have rats sleeping with us. We don't have lice and bed bugs with us. But we at least get to see what it would have been like and allow the public to see what it would have been like for these men to go over the top, cross no man's land into a withering fire of rifles and machine guns. And that basically you're just, I hate to say it, but almost on a suicide run.
What do you think you've learned from being a part of that experience?
You know, when you do reenacting, at least for me, it's the little things. The things that people don't really consider that mean the most to me. And I'll just use you as an example, the gas mask. You know, the gas mask is an iconic part of World War I soldiers. And, of course, we didn't have any. I mean, we're using British or French. Later on, we will develop our own gas masks. But for the guys like my friend who uses a French gas mask, it looks like a feed bag that goes over his head. And he's got a pair of, I'll call them goggles, the lenses. And in about 30 seconds, he's steamed up and he can't see. For me, I wore the British gas mask. And, you know, you never realize that you've got to have this mouthpiece, this hard rubber mouthpiece that goes inside your mouth. You've got this big spring that pinches your nose shut. Then you're trying to breathe through this long tube, which goes down into this can, which is stuck inside a canvas pack on your chest. And you're trying to suck air through this filter. And at the very bottom of this can is a hole that's probably, oh, I'll say the size of a half dollar. And it's you're trying to run, you're trying to maneuver. If he's trying to fight in actual combat, I mean, it would just drain the air out of you. And on top of that, your goggles fog up, so you really can't see what you're doing. So I think, you know, that's just one little thing. And there's probably a million more things which I start getting a better understanding of how and why things were done.
So you can't see and you can't breathe. And yep. As you mentioned, all of the real hardships are something that you don't have to deal with. But if you think about the exhaustion and the mud and mm-hmm. the vermin and the fact that you've been living in those conditions for so long, I mean, that really drives home at least an inkling of what that experience must have been like.
Yeah. And I mean, you stop and think with these guys, and it's kind of like what Mike was saying earlier, that they're sitting here in a 6-8 foot deep ditch. They have mud up to your knees. The mud was probably one of the worst things. The mud was so thick that men, in certain places of the front, men couldn't move. It would pull your boots off. It'd pull your clothes off. It plugged your weapons up. There's accounts of men drowning in the mud. There's stories of being so much mud in the trenches that a wounded man might find himself being laid on the corpse of another man just to keep him out of the mud. Again, the filth that's in there, and World War One battlefields stunk. I mean, you've got dead bodies out there that have not been retrieved, or if they have took time for a truce to bury the bodies, you've got artillery coming in. It's churning that ground up. It's digging these bodies up. It's tearing bodies apart. It's reburying them. And then you've got the men with simple stuff as their, you know, their own body waste. You've got to throw it over the trench. So if you get a shell in front of you, it lands right back in there with you. It's just a horror. I mean, probably the best way to describe, if a person wants to experience the trenches of World War One, go out, dig a hole in your yard, fill it half full of water, and then get all your neighbors to shoot at you. That's probably the best way to look at it.
We're talking about the experience of World War One today, both abroad and at home in Iowa, marking the 100th anniversary of the U.S. entering World War One. With me, Rusty Corder. He's a historian and former college history professor, and he's also a military reenactor, including World War One reenactments. Also with me, Mike Vogt, curator of the Iowa Gold Star Military Museum in Johnston, and Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa in Des Moines. And Mike, I mean, World War One, we know a lot more today about post-traumatic stress syndrome, but World War One is really where we started to at least understand that the men who fought in these conditions were forever changed. This is where the term shell-shocked came from, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Part of the tactical methodology in the First World War, in order to soften up the location of an intended attack, to cut belts of wire 50 yards thick and miles long, was to initiate an artillery barrage that could last hours, if not half a day or an entire day. So a soldier hunkered down in his position in a dugout in a trench would have to undergo this incessant shelling on and on for a great length of time. And that, as you can imagine, would grate on the nerves in probably a very short amount of time. And hence the term, as you mentioned, shell shock, is spawned by the First World War. In fact, a study after World War One revealed that in veterans' hospitals across the nation in the first decade after the First World War, 3 out of every 5 patients that were admitted were there because of psychological disorders caused by their service in the war.
The new display at the State Historical Museum, Iowa and the Great War, that opens on April 6th, Leo, I know that you focus a lot on the individuals who we know of who went and served during World War One, the stories that have come back. And I would love to talk about a few of those individuals. One, it's a name that lives on in Des Moines in many different ways, and that is Merle Hay. Now, you may think of the mall first, but let's talk about the real Merle Hay.
Well, if you want to go visit Mike's museum at Camp Dodge, the road you will take is Merle Hay Road, and that was dedicated in the early 1920s. Merle Hay was a young man from Glidden in Carroll County, so west central Iowa, and he was part of the troops that were in France. On November 3rd, he's one of the first 3 Americans who give their lives in service. So he's well known all through the 1920s, 30s, 40s, into the 1970s if you're a central Iowan. But it does get – the war gets called the Forgotten War, and even the names that are more prominent around central Iowa or across the state, they're forgotten names. So we have a little feature on Merle Hay in our new exhibit.
And the Forgotten War, is that because World War II came so shortly after World War One and sort of overshadowed it?
I'd also say just our participation in World War One was so not by the standard of loss of life or service, but was only a year and a few months, whereas World War II, we are engaged from 1941 or late 41 until 1945, and it's a two-front war, Asia and Europe both. And World War One does get then overshadowed in the service, and as time passes and the veterans are gone, though they may be memorialized in certain ways, or even the women who served have been memorialized across Iowa, because those veterans aren't around to tell those stories unless places like Mike's Museum and other museums across the state and the State Museum share those stories, we forget about them.
In doing your research, obviously, you know, the State Historical Society has been collecting artifacts for so long. Do you have a lot of artifacts from World War I, or was that a more difficult challenge?
That was one of the things the historical department, as the museum was known in the 1920s, Edgar Harlan, the curator, and the state recognized how we had just participated in what was believed the war to end all wars. That's not just a cliche, but they really thought that. And so they went out and collected. And so a man named Leo Friel was a man who had served. He was from Clark County, a small town of Murray. He gave some of his things. His brother had been up at Iowa State College, now Iowa State University, and died of the flu and the flu epidemic of late 1918, of the fall of 1918. So Leo donated his brother Galen's memorial certificate. That's a piece we'll have in our exhibit. And then Leo gave his Croix de Guerre, the French awarded medal that he won. And the Winterset newspaper described him as at one time during the battle having been shell-shocked, and he wasn't able to participate at one time, but then kept fighting and came back being his jovial self after the war. So whatever help Leo Friel got, he was able to recover.
Well, and you mentioned women. You do have some artifacts from women who served during the war, who served as nurses. Grace Van Evra of Davenport?
Grace Van Evra has a great collection at our Iowa City Centennial Building, both manuscripts and some individual items. She then comes. She serves in France as a nurse in the Red Cross for Iowa, and then comes back and has a long nursing career across the state of Iowa. So we have her story told through a photograph and text. And then Ruth Pickell, who is a Des Moines nurse and served stateside the whole time, we have her full ensemble as a Red Cross nurse. We don't have her hat in the exhibit, but we do own her full ensemble. So those are some stories that, again, people wouldn't necessarily go out to say, oh, I want to learn about Ruth Pickell or Grace Van Evra, and yet they made great contributions to our state and our country, and it's important to tell their story too.
You're welcome to join our conversation this hour with stories that have been passed down in your family about World War I. You can give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number, and Margaret is on the line in Ames. Hi, Margaret.
Hello.
Hi, and you have a story about your grandfather serving in World War I.
My grandfather was from rural Iowa, central Iowa, and he went to France out of Des Moines, and he was in the veterinary corps. And when he was in France caring for horses, and I shall say, I don't know which happened first, but he recognized a horse that he had worked with on a farm in Iowa, a neighbor or a this had been a horse that was used on a farm, and it was donated or purchased by the government. And I don't know if the horse recognized him first or if he recognized the horse first, but it was a quiet reunion in the fields of France.
Wow. Margaret, that's amazing. So did your grandfather like to tell you that story? Was that...
I think my mom told me. He never related it, but he was also had the flu, and I'm assuming it's the flu. And his friends put him in a loft in a barn and gave him horse medicine, and he survived. So those were the stories that I heard from my grandfather's experience in the war. So he spent his flu in the hayloft of a barn with shells falling on the roof, apparently. Wow. That was the other part, that they were being shelled, and he would listen to the bullets and the shells landing on the roof and bouncing down.
Wow.
So
Well, Margaret, yeah, thank you so much for sharing those stories with us today. And again, you're welcome to share your stories that have been passed down in your family. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me this hour, Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa, Mike Vogt, curator of the Iowa Gold Star Military Museum in Johnston, and Rusty Corder, thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to be here.
Rusty Corder, a historian, a former college history professor and museum curator. He has also been a military reenactor for many years. We were talking with him about his reenactment of World War I battles. We'll continue our conversation about Iowa's role in World War I in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
And the word over there, that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drums rum coming everywhere.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're looking back at the entrance of Iowa, of the United States, into World War I. War was declared on April 6th, 1917. That's when the United States declared war on Germany. Of course, World War I had been going on since 1914. But even after that declaration, in the final year of the war, more than 114,000 Iowans served in the U.S. Armed Forces. 3,576 Iowans lost their lives. You're welcome to join our conversation with the stories passed down in your family. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. They'll be opening their new exhibit, Iowa and the Great War, on April 6th at 9 a.m. And Mike Vogt is also here, curator of the Iowa Gold Star Military Museum in Johnston. And let's get to the phones. David is on the line in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Hi, David.
Hello. I'm originally from Davenport, and the legend goes that the first woman killed in World War I, her name was Marion Crandall. She was originally, I think, from Keokuk or Burlington, but she ended up in Davenport, and she taught French at a school called St. Catherine's, which is no longer around, but... She became a nurse, and she ended up in France, and that's what I've heard, is she was the first American woman killed in World War I.
Have either one of you heard about that story, Leo or Mike?
I'll jump in.
Okay.
So Marion Crandall, he's exactly right. She was a teacher in Davenport. She was actually a native of Cedar Rapids, and she's the first American woman killed in combat. She dies on March 27th, 1918. She had, as I said, was born in Cedar Rapids. Her family moved to Nebraska for a while, so the Omaha area also claims Marion at times. And then in the early 19-teens, she goes to what was an Episcopal school, the St. Catherine's School, and teaches French in Davenport for a number of years. And then when she dies, the Episcopal Diocese of Iowa makes sure to tell her story. There's a marker in Davenport recognizing her. So that's, again, one of those under-recognized stories. We tell it briefly in our exhibit that in addition to Merle Hay, we also have the first woman who lost her life. And then another story that's in the exhibit, and I'll be brief on this one, Charity. But what is probably the last African-American to lose his life in World War I on behalf of the United States is a man from Centerville named Wayman Minor. And he's another story that is part of our cultural app, and also we'll use his picture.
Well, and you mentioned the editorial written in a local African-American paper, and African-Americans, of course, were called up to fight in World War I, and many African-American officers were trained at Fort Des Moines. Tell me a little bit more about that history.
That's exactly right. In June of 1918, the federal government recognizes it's not ready to integrate our forces, but at least African-American men are just as brave and can serve just as well. And so to train African-Americans, the idea is we'll have them train in the northern United States, where there might be a little more acceptance to training African-Americans for military service. And so there are a number of Iowa men who train through Fort Des Moines, the man who goes on to buy the Iowa Bystander, the African-American newspaper, James Morris, he had moved to Des Moines to be a lawyer. And so he enlists and is trained and serves and is wounded over in France in late 1918. And it's now a national historic landmark. So if you want to learn about Iowa's contributions to World War I, another great site is Fort Des Moines on the south side of Des Moines.
Now, we have a question from Marty in Northwood, and I'm sure you both have a lot of recommendations for this, but they are asking if you have a recommendation for a book, movie, or a documentary that truly depicts the World War I experience.
It's an old book, about a half century old, on the causation of the war and the early battles, is The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman. It's one I would recommend. Another one that by the same author, Barbara Tuchman, that details America's entry in the war, and the Zimmerman Telegram is titled just that, The Zimmerman Telegram. It's hard for me to pick one book on the First World War, but some of the more popular ones I'm sure can be found on the shelves at the public library, or if there's a college library close by, you want to examine those for reference. I would recommend those two sources.
And, of course, we had, we've had, for example, Saving Private Ryan, which really, as far as cinematic contributions go, really helped a lot of people understand the horrors of World War II. I can't think of a movie that might really transport you into World War I. What about you, Leo? Anything come to mind?
Well, there are some of the classics, actually, like All Quiet on the Western Front, that, you know, are the fictional depictions but truly based in or fictionalized depictions that truly do show the experience of the men serving and the people exposed to the war. So that's a good classic there. And some of Hemingway's materials, too, are good period pieces on wartime experience.
You might be able to find on DVD, it was a made-for-cable movie starring Rick Schroeder called The Lost Battalion, and that covers the experiences of a American battalion that advances beyond the rest of the American lines and ends up being surrounded by German forces and battle it out for 4 or 5 days until their rescue.
Mm-hmm. And Charity, just one more quick point. Mm-hmm. There's also Iowa Public Television will be running starting Monday night, the American Experience Great War series. So that's a three-parter that if you want to catch something current, that'll be coming up this next week.
Let's go back to the phones. Hilda is on the line in West Des Moines. Hi, Hilda.
Hi.
Hi, and you have a really unusual connection to World War I. Tell us about it.
I do. I guess it was my great aunt, and before the war, she was actually the governess to Kaiser Wilhelm's children. And as young women did in the day, when she got married, she stopped working and followed her new husband here to America. And again, as was done, the Kaiser gifted her lavishly, you know, for her service to the family, and barrels of china and all kinds of things. But the prized possession of all the things he gifted her was an oil painting, a portrait of Wilhelm himself, which she, you know, lovingly, you know, hung in her living room here in the States. And she did not understand when the family told her, when the war broke out, you have to stop speaking German and you must take down that portrait. She said, but he was such a nice man, you know, because she only knew him from that family perspective.
Oh, wow. Hilda, thank you so much for sharing that. And Leo, that brings us to the fact that there were so many Germans living in Iowa. And, you know, in the early years of the war, there may have been some tensions. But once the United States entered that war, the tensions really rose. What happened on the home front?
Well, in addition to Governor Harding issuing the proclamation banning all foreign languages, but it really was intended toward Germans, you had local communities, places like Hull and small towns across the state, where if someone was not seen as being sufficiently patriotic or too friendly toward Germans, you might have your storefront painted yellow. There was a drugstore up in Hull where the drugstore owner was run out of town, and that was not a singular incident. There were incidents all over the state where individuals would have their businesses or their homes attacked.
And that continued in Iowa. I mean, the tension remained after the war, didn't it?
Well, you had the issue of the 1924 Immigration Act that then had really been the perspective of a lot of people in the United States through the eugenics movement and other – and if you're – most of the listeners I know what eugenics is, but the idea that some cultural traditions and genetic backgrounds are superior to others. And it's what does give rise to a degree to the Nazi movement. But there were a number of American academics who also were supportive of the eugenics movement. And as Americans were concerned about immigrants to our country, that was one of the motivating factors for the 1924 Immigration Act to Asians had, for the most part, been excluded in the late 19th century, but it really locked down any immigration on Asians, and it certainly locked down immigration on Southern Europeans and Eastern Europeans.
Let's go back to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Steve is on the line in Clear Lake. Hi, Steve. Steve, are you there? We seem to have lost Steve. You can join our conversation with your stories about World War I that have been passed down in your families. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is from Connie in Grinnell. She says, listening to your show now reminds me of my grandfather who served in World War I. My memory of his story is that he was a runner in World War I, charged with running across enemy lines to deliver messages. The Linville Historical Museum has his uniform on display, along with World War II uniforms of his children. And I mean, Leo, I know that you've gathered many artifacts together for the State Historical Museum and your new exhibit, but many, many other historical museums around the state of Iowa also must have artifacts from that time.
There are, just like Mike's Museum is one of the best. You've got the Sullivan Brothers up in Waterloo that has a great collection. There are a number of other sites across the state and county museums. In Colfax, they have a small display related to American pilot James Norman Hall. We have the jacket that he was wearing when he was shot down in France and so is ripped through the left side.
But although he lived to tell that story.
He did live to tell that story and a few others, including Mutiny on the Bounty. So,
well, okay, spell this out for me. He was the co-author of Mutiny on the Bounty?
That's right. He and another friend who served with him in France decided to essentially become fiction writers together, and they did a handful of books together. They moved to Tahiti, and for the most part, he lived most of his life then in the tropics, but he stayed in contact with family in Iowa. He still has grandchildren who are around, and we've corresponded with them. So they're excited to know that their grandfather's story is still being shared in Iowa.
Wow. Steve is back on the line in Clear Lake. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Charity.
What's your story?
A quick story. My grandfather lived in rural Mississippi and was called up to go to the draft board to talk about being drafted. And it turned out that he was not eligible to be drafted for whatever reason, and he got home and found that his young wife had committed suicide because she was afraid that he was going to be drafted and sent off to war. So he was left with a young daughter and a dead wife.
Steve, thanks so much for sharing that story, and I guess that drives home the fear of so many individuals in Iowa and on the home front of having to go and fight in that war. Can you put this in perspective for us? Mike, with the number of Iowans who were called up to fight in World War I, would it have felt like all the young men were gone?
Well, 524,000 Iowans registered for the Selective Service, or a.k.a. the draft, during the First World War. About 74,000 were called up for service, and after exemptions and rejections for a variety of reasons, 6,900 ended up serving as a result of the draft. But for a state population of maybe a little over a million at that time, or several million, 2 million, having 114,000 pulls a lot of individuals from farms, factories, fields, and small towns all across the state. So the impact of the war was certainly felt by communities large and small.
And, of course, many of those young men from Iowa that went to serve were also of German heritage. I mean, Leo, we talked about how difficult it was for Germans on the home front, but many of those soldiers were also German.
And I think they were not more patriotic, but certainly as patriotic as any other Iowans. We've got this Schmidt family who is up in Clayton County, Garnavillo. We've got a victory ribbon or a patriotic ribbon, red, white, and blue ribbon that his parents owned, and he's serving over in France. So that's something that came to us from the Schmidt family in Garnavillo. The majority of the German population is just as engaged in the war effort as the rest of our state.
Let's go back to the phones. Lori is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Lori.
Hi. My dad fought. He was a Brit, and he fought in Europe, went through. They were put on donkeys, went through Turkey, and ended up by the Baltic Sea, talked about huge oranges. And he was with Dennegan's White Raiders. And they were supposed to be, I don't know if they were fighting against the Bolsheviks or to keep the Bolsheviks in power. He was sparse with details, but anyway, and then came to the U.S. and was enlisted in World War II here. So.
Oh, wow. A lot of history there, which also, World War I changed a lot in our globe as far as changing the whole geopolitical landscape. And we're nearly out of time, but I think Lori's comment kind of gives us a little bit of insight into how governments were shifting. And of course, we continued to see that in World War II and after. With just a minute left, Mike, I know that you have already held some commemorative events at the Gold Star Military Museum in Johnston. How will you mark the day on Thursday, the 100th anniversary?
We hope to see some visitors out to our shop before they go to visit the State Historical Museum. And we had our event this last Saturday simply because we didn't want to conflict with what was going on at the State Museum. And secondly, because there are going to be a lot of other commemorative events that drew some of our volunteers and reenactors away.
Sure.
But you struck at the heart of what should be remembered about the First World War. Every American Legion post in every town in Iowa, the American Legion was a byproduct of the First World War, organized by Great War veterans. And also another aspect is that winning the war, it's just as important to win the peace because the seeds of World War II and a lot of borders drawn around the world were a byproduct of the Great War.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Mike Vogt, curator of the Iowa Gold Star Military Museum in Johnston. Leo Landis, thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
Leo Landis is curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa in Des Moines. And Iowa and the Great War, the new exhibit at the State Historical Museum, opens on April 6th at 9 a.m. There'll also be a program, German Iowans in World War I, on April 8th at 1:30 p.m., an opportunity to learn about Iowa during the war. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.